You're listening to the Boogeyman's Closet podcast. Explicit language and spoilers ahead. You've been warned. And we are back for yet another episode of the Boogeyman's Closet. As always, I am Mike Alvarez.
Maurice Killifer.
Susie Hunt.
And we have a guest joining us today.
Eric Butel.
Welcome back, Eric. Thank you for joining us again. Always good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Anytime. And this is, we are continuing our Halloween horror movies with episode 66. And Susie, I know you've been waiting for us to get to this.
Oh, it's- I have.
House of a Thousand Corpses from 2003. It's an hour and 29 minutes, directed by the man himself, Rob Zombie. This is our second Rob Zombie film. Obviously, fans of the show would know The Devil's Rejects, Three from Hell, the Halloween remakes, Lords of Salem, 31, and The Haunted World of El Superbisto. So let's go around the table. Eric, we'll start with you since you're our guest. What do you think about this movie?
I like it. I do. It's... I mean, it's basically it's his first movie, and that's obvious. But I like the haunted house, almost like supernatural stuff he did, and that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Considering I think he like started it as a ride, and then it became a ride, or sorry, like a haunted house at a Universal or something. But anyways, no, I like it. I like the aesthetic, and it's. But it's like just on the cusp, I think, of like his other like really good movies. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I don't know, there's some stuff that it does and doesn't work for me. But there's something about his movies in general. And this you can definitely see from like the first frame. It feels like somebody's lived it. And even if it's like weird or grotesque or it doesn't like add up in your brain, like, you can tell like he grew up in a carnival or something.
Right.
And it does help the movie and it makes it feel lived in. And it, I don't know. And it makes like the horror aspects and even some of the more outlandish stuff. It gives a lot of credence to that, I think.
No, I would agree.
But yeah, I like it. I remember when I was very excited to see it when it came out in the theaters, like finally, because I remember those trailers made it seem like it was going to be the scariest thing ever made and that like Satan was going to arrive on Earth when the movie came out. And yep. Then it got delayed. Like it never came out. And then when it finally came out, I remember I saw it with a couple of my friends and my one friend and I liked it because we just liked the haunted house feel of it so much. And our other friend, he just couldn't kind of get past it. He was just like, no, but I loved it. Yeah.
Same. Susie, what about you? I know this is one of your favorites, so we'll go.
Oh, yes. This is one of my favorite movies of the last 20 years. I remember, like Eric, seeing all the trailers. Oh, it's going to come out. It's going to come out. And then it didn't come out till 2003. And I actually, on the trailer, Mike, that you posted, I tagged my friend Sal, because this movie always reminds me of him, because it was one of the first movies that we had ever gone to see together. Mm-hmm. And we would just go back and forth quoting everything. I love that, like, raw, like, the cutscenes, that raw, grainy, like, grindhouse feel to it. Mm-hmm. And the whole haunted house. And then just, I can see how someone may not like it because you have Dr. Wolfenstein at the very beginning. But then he really isn't in it. Like, it's almost like filler. And I can see how some parts of it, like, you might be like, wait, how the fuck did that happen? Like, you got crazy hillbillies a la Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and then you go to the other extreme, but still blend it in with, like, mutant zombies.
Right.
I just, I love his aesthetic. I love the cinematography. Baby is one of my favorite anti-heroes of all time, or villains, I should say.
I was gonna say, I wouldn't really call her an anti-hero, no. Personally.
I also want to preface this by saying that I've seen this movie so much, I've been down with a migraine for the last 2 days. I could still watch it, because it was really just a refresher so I could make notes. I love this movie. She's one of my favorite villains. I think Karen Black is fantastic. I've always loved Rainn Wilson, which if you guys haven't watched, watch Utopia, because that's friggin' amazing.
Oh yeah.
But I love this movie.
Yeah. Maurice, what about you?
I like this movie. Kind of like what everyone else is saying. It's it's not the best Rob Zombie movie, but it's up there. I do like the grindhouse style as well. I know a lot of people complain because it's too much like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I mean, if it's one of his inspirations, it's going to feel that way and look that way.
Right.
So it's not like he was copying him. There wasn't a maniac running around with a chainsaw killing people.
Right.
Right.
So
and I mean, Toby Hooper loved it.
Right. So I think people just like to bitch and complain.
I think part of it too, just to piggyback on that, is there was all this hype because it was filmed in 2000, I believe, mm-hmm. and not released until 3 years later. So we're getting all these teaser trailers. And I remember going online and there was like some website that I would always go to and it would like release a different character in their biography, like every week or so. And it just got built up to be like this, like Eric said, this is going to be the, like the scariest, most gruesome thing you've ever seen. But he had to cut so much out so it would get the R rating. And when it came out on DVD, I bought it because I was like, I have to have this. And then I thought, okay, then I'll just buy the director's cut. Well, that never came out. And then I'm like, all right, 10-year, they'll have a director's cut, nothing. So I have my fingers crossed that at the 20th anniversary of this movie, there'll be a director's cut Blu-ray that has like all those extra elements that he had to cut out so it wouldn't get an NC-17.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news.
I know, but stop. A girl can dream.
Well, I was just going to say, from what I read, that footage has been lost.
I know, but a girl can dream. Maurice still believes in Santa Claus.
That's very true, so.
The punished kind.
Anything. Oh, it's definitely the punished kind.
But you were saying, Maurice, sorry.
But yes, I enjoy this movie. It's my second favorite of the trilogy.
Yeah, mine too.
First being obviously Three from Hell. Kidding. Devil's Rejects. So the movie has a couple scenes that did not age well. It didn't really bother me, but like the whole skunk ape part looked like a early PlayStation game
because of the inverted lens.
Yeah, but I mean, other than that, no, I mean, it didn't bother me that much. But like, oh, I hate the movie. But
right, surprised you didn't bring up the soundtrack.
Oh, I was going there next. No, I love the soundtrack. Actually, same. I listened to it on my way home from work today to get me pumped up for the podcast.
I was listening to it last night while I was writing my notes.
It's such a good soundtrack.
It really is.
But I love the actors in it. It has such a great cast.
Oh God. When we get to the cast, like I'm going to have a hard time because everybody.
It's huge.
And not only that, but everybody in a Rob Zombie film just has this pedigree of like being in a shitload of cool movies or cool projects.
Yeah.
So even if it's not like well known, it's cool stuff.
And last but not least, it introduces my all time favorite character.
Ah, yes.
Captain Spaulding.
Yep. I know you're a huge Spaulding fan.
Or did he start off in the animated movie?
No, this was first.
Okay, this is first appearance. I wasn't sure. El Super Beasto.
Yeah, that came. El Super Beasto came between this and Devil's Rejects.
Oh yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Came between Devil's Rejects and Halloween. Sorry. So it was after Devil's Rejects.
Okay, but still. Okay, so yeah, I thought so. Let's say it introduces my favorite character, but Mike knows how much I love Captain Spaulding. I even dressed up as him for Halloween one year.
I was going to say, you need to post on social media that picture because it was an awesome costume.
That's awesome. Yeah.
My brother did some good makeup work that night.
Absolutely. But
yeah, other than that, I'll give it to you.
I mean, for me, it's I'm conflicted because I love this movie. I was obsessed with this movie before it came out. Watching it critically, I can definitely see what Rob Zombie and critics have said, where it is a bit of a mess. It's one of those things where, you know, watching it critically for the show, I was deducting points left and right in like, you know, stuff I would normally get excited about. It doesn't hold together well as a cohesive story. I still love it. I will always love this movie. I have great, like, nostalgia tied to it, and it's just a fucking fun ride. It's a carnival ride. Like,
and for all you critics out there, Rob Zombie has said the same thing.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, you know, I did listen to his commentary again after watching this. And, you know, yeah, he's very critical of this film. But you can it reminds me of the first comic book I did, where it's like, I hate looking back at that comic. I mean, it's such a fucking mess. The artwork is terrible.
Was it the Oh Pie one?
Yeah.
That's how I, like, kind of met you.
That's true.
I liked it. So well, thank you.
I still have my copy.
But see, Eric, you don't have to be nice. That book
is shit. I know it's garbage now, but no, it's one of those things where it's like, I had such a great time making it, and I will always be thankful for that book, like, for what it brought and for the friendships that I founded while making that book. But at the same time, like, it is a mess. It's a god-awful, herky-jerky mess. And when you don't know how to properly tell a story, like, when it's your first outing, it is very hard to rein all your thoughts in and rein everything in and chop it down to a cohesive story. And I feel like he really did. I think it's, I'm sure you guys have heard the phrase before. A lot of writers say, kill your darlings. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, writing a script, like, or writing a story, you have to edit and then edit again and basically boil it down to its best possible state. And for a first time outing, that's very hard to do. And I feel like what he did with The Devil's Rejects is exactly that. He killed his darlings and he made a fucking amazing movie. And, like, not just as, like, a Rob Zombie fan or a horror fan, but, like, looking at that film critically, it is a fantastic fucking movie. Like, from start to finish, he didn't even need to do anything before or after that film. Like, that is a standalone masterpiece. This, as, like, the ingredients for that, is a bit of a mess, but I will always love it. What, much like you guys, I was, you know, seeing the early trailers and I was hearing about it and I was obsessed. This is back in 2000 when they first started showing the teasers. And I was constantly scouring online trying to find new information. And there was a brief period of time when it wasn't, there was kind of unknown what was going to happen when Universal had shelved the project before Lionsgate took over, and Rob Zombie sold on his website about 200 copies of the script, and they sold out pretty fucking fast. But then, of course, people did photocopies and sold them on eBay. I grabbed one of the photocopies. Now, it was like $15, you know, for a fucking photocopied script. But this is like 2002, I believe it was, 2001 or 2002. I was still living in my parents' house. And I got the script. I couldn't wait to read it. And I just sat there and couldn't put it down. Like, I read it from cover to cover and was in fucking love with this story. The movie we got is very different from what was in that script, particularly the ending. So when I got to the end of the movie, the first time I saw it in the theater, I was not only shocked, but I was very disappointed. Like, I was really upset that it wasn't the ending that was in the script.
That it was in Hugo?
Yes.
Yeah, wasn't it supposed to be the grandpa or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way they did it was so good, because it's the scene where Otis was telling Jerry, he's like, you know, I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Satan. And then he wheels up Hugo and he goes, take a good look, boy. Here's your Dr. Satan. And then he says, the boogeyman is real and you found him. Like, that whole thing was right there. And there's the zombies that Dr. Satan had experimented on. Like, the whole final sequence was a catacomb chase with zombies. And it just seemed to fit so fucking well. The whole Dr. Satan professor thing, while at this point I love it because, you know, it's been enough time that I actually do enjoy that stuff. It felt so jarring and out of place. Like, it didn't fit for me. And it's probably because I went into it having read the script. So, but anyway, long and short of it is, I still love this movie, even with all of its glaring flaws. So let's get into the cast. Now, I'm going to try my best not to read their entire fucking list, because I wrote down, like, everything, and I have, like, 2 pages here because of it. So, starting it off, we have Mother Firefly, played by Karen Black. Trilogy of Terror, Burnt Offerings, the last horror movie, not the one I'm always talking about, and one of my favorite Tobe Hooper movies next to Texas Chainsaw, the Invaders from Mars remake from 1986. It's such a ridiculous movie. And of course, Murder, She Wrote. So right off the bat, we got our Murder, She Wrote connection. We got Baby Firefly, played by Sherry Moon Zombie. She was in, obviously, pretty much everything Rob Zombie has done. But she was also in the Toolbox Murders remake, which was a Tobe Hooper film. And then CSI Miami.
She only did that because Rob Zombie asked her because they were friends. And that's the only non-Rob Zombie movie she's ever been in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's and from what I read, Tobe Hooper was so impressed with this movie that's the whole reason he wanted her in it.
Yep.
Because he was such a fan of this.
She was in Nashville, too. Have you ever seen that? The Robert Altman movie?
Mm-hmm. No, never saw that one.
Yeah. She's pretty good.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I know a lot of people don't like her acting. Like, they think that she's terrible. I don't think she's bad. I've never really had a complaint, like, even in Lords of Salem, where everyone's like, she can't carry a movie. I'm like, I thought she was really fucking good. So, you know, haters gonna hate.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Potatoes gonna potate.
Then we have Tiny Firefly, played by Matthew McGrory. The first thing I ever saw him in was The Dead Hate the Living, which I hope we get on this show one day. But he was also in Bubble Boy, which, you know, is surprisingly a fun movie. Big Fish, Carnival, Constantine, and then, of course, The Devil's Rejects. Let's see. We have Rufus, played by Robert Alan Mukes. He was in Sliders, The Forbidden Highway, Weeds, Criminal Minds, The Mindy Project, and Bone Tomahawk, another one I'd like to get on this show.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really good movie if you guys haven't seen it. Then we got Otis B. Driftwood, played by Bill Moseley. Now, this guy's a fucking legend. Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, The Blob, Freddy's Nightmare, Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, which we talked about last year. Ugh. How terrible that movie is.
You can just skip it.
The remake of Night of the Living Dead, Night of the Living Dead 1990, which we will one day have on this show. Army of Darkness. He was in that video game for Sega CD, Corpse Killer. Like, he's in everything. I mean, we already saw him once in Repo, the Genetic Opera. You know, and then he even has a great cameo in the Nickelodeon Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, where he's basically playing Chop Top. It's fantastic. So Maurice, your favorite, we got Captain Spaulding, played by Sid Haig, another fucking legend, man. This guy
was rest in peace.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. I got to meet early on when I was going to conventions, and he was just the nicest dude. Like, he was so happy to talk to people.
Somebody, I forget where I read it, but somebody said when he was, you know, even when he was like shooting Three from Hell, just prior to that, he was still doing like conventions for like charities and stuff, even though he was pretty far gone at that point, I think.
Yeah,
but somebody said he just kept doing conventions because he loved to do it. So,
oh yeah, and that's the thing, you could tell. Like when I met him, it was 2003 at Wizard World in Chicago. I was telling, like, I was gushing about, you know, obviously how much I liked this movie, and I bought a mini poster and had him sign it and all that and got a photo with him, and he started going on about the sequel, and he goes, I can't really tell you much. He's like, but the script is amazing. So I'm like, oh my God, we're getting a sequel. Like, I was so excited about it. And he was happy to talk to everybody. Like, you know, I was trying to like move aside and let other people, you know, come up, but he was like, oh, no, no, he was talking to everybody. Like, he was like, stay here, let me tell you some stuff. And he was just going on about how fun this movie was to film, about how much he liked working with Rob Zombie, like how much he loved Bill Moseley. Like, he was just genuinely happy to talk about making a movie with people who liked the movie. Like, he just seemed like a really genuine guy. So, you know, rest in peace, Sid Haig. But I mean, this guy was in everything, like I said, from Batman 66 to Star Trek, you know, pretty much all of Rob Zombie's movies since this. He was also in Bone Tomahawk. He was in that god-awful Night of the Living Dead 3D. That's so bad. But he's in it. He's actually the reason I bought it. And then a movie that, once again, I will find a way to get on here is Galaxy of Terror, that Roger Corman flick. It's that movie scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. It's so bad, though. But then we have Grandpa Hugo, played by Dennis Fimple. He was in a lot of television stuff, like The Dukes of Hazzard, Twilight Zone, Quantum Leap. But he was also in King Kong 76, so the 1976 remake. Then we got Denise Willis, played by Aaron Daniels. The Outer Limits, Dexter, The L-Word, Law and Order. And then we have Jerry Goldsmith, played by Chris Hardwick. 30-something, Married with Children, Terminator 3, Halloween 2, and then obviously, you know, all the Walking Dead stuff, like Talking Dead. He was a walker in The Walking Dead. Does a ton of voice work for, like, Family Guy, Robot Chicken, all that stuff.
Who was he in Terminator 3?
You know, I didn't write down who he was, but apparently he was, like, some kind of, like, you know, on-screen, like, walk-on role type thing.
Oh, okay.
Just because, you know, he's, like, the perpetual fanboy. He's the Nerdist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then we have Mary Knowles, played by Jennifer Jostin. She was in, I don't know if you guys remember this, that late 90s or I should say mid 90s horror movie called Milo about the little kid.
I don't remember that.
It's a terrible movie, but she's in that. Then there's Deep Impact, ER, NYPD Blue, Scrubs, and my most loathed of the American Horror Stories, Murder House. I know I always take flack for that, but I hate that one.
I'm going to let that slide in the interest of time.
And then we have Bill Hudley, played by Rainn Wilson. We already saw him once with Cooties, but he's also in Utopia, as you mentioned, The Meg, which is another one I'd like to get on here. He was in Reno 911, The Office, and Super. I think we talked about this on Cooties, but guys, if you haven't seen that movie, check it out. It's fucking awesome. Then Sheriff Frank Houston, played by William Bissett, General Hospital, Bonanza, The Love Boat, the Invaders from Mars remake. And then he did voices for Diablo, Warcraft 3, and Fallout 3, which I thought was kind of cool. So I'm like, oh, I've clearly heard this guy's voice because I've played all those. Then Steve Nash, played by one of my favorites, Walter Goggins. I love this dude. He's great in everything. But he's another Murder, She Wrote, but he did Murder, She Wrote, The Last Free Man, one of the TV movies. But he was in Predators, Straw Dogs, Lincoln, Django Unchained, Officer Down, Machete Kills, Sons of Anarchy, The Hateful Eight, and The Ant-Man and the Wasp. So this guy, and I mean, he's another one with a huge IMDb list. Like
he's also in this great show called The Unicorn.
I don't think I've seen that.
It's really good. Because when you're a widow, he loses his wife, she dies, and then about a year later he starts looking again. And when you're single and have kids at that age, they call you a unicorn.
Oh, okay.
He's this really good guy, but obviously has had some bad luck.
Right.
Yeah, you know, he's recent. Yeah, it's really good.
I was like, because I really like him as an actor. Like, every role I've seen him in, I've really enjoyed. I especially loved him in both Django and The Hateful Eight. Like, Quentin Tarantino really knew what to do with this guy. He was a really good actor in those movies. But then we have Deputy George Wydell, played by Tom Towles, who we've already seen. He was Otis in Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. But we will be seeing him again in Night of the Living Dead 1990, because, like I said, I want to get that on here. But he was also in Seinfeld, The Rock, the Halloween. Actually, we saw him again. He was in the Halloween remake. I forgot about that. He was in Firefly. Susie, I know you like that.
Yep.
And then we have Revelli, another one we've seen, played by Erwin Keyes. He was in Friday the 13th, The Warriors, the Exterminator movies, and then a shitload of television, like Laverne and Shirley, The Jeffersons, Married with Children, all that. He was in the Tales from the Crypt episode Maniac at Large, which is a really good episode about a librarian terrified about a killer that's on the loose. And she's like, she's working late and she thinks the killer is outside. And I won't ruin the twist, but there's a really good twist to that one. He was in the Sega CD video game Double Switch.
Oh, nice.
I loved that game. And then some I just had to write down here. He was in Dahmer versus Gacy and Evil Bong 3, The Wrath of Bong.
Full moon features.
Yep. Then we have Stucky, played by Michael J. Pollard, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Gunsmoke, Lost in Space, American Gothic, Scrooged. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, didn't you mention him before, Susie?
Yes.
Because I remember you talking about Scrooged.
Yeah, he was Herman, the poor guy that freezes to death in the sewer.
Yeah. That's right. I forgot what character he played. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
I think he was nominated for an Academy Award, too. Not for that, for, I think, Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, he's a good actor.
Like, I wrote that down. I don't know if that's true, but I remember him from, like, everything, every Western, it seems like.
Oh, he was also in a lot of, like, random television shows like Erie, Indiana and stuff like that. He was in
Sleepaway. I loved Erie, Indiana.
Oh, me too.
Oh, man. We should do that.
Right? There we go. There's some Patreon content. Erie, Indiana. Sleepaway Camp 3, Teenage Wasteland. Now, I know we only did the first Sleepaway Camp, but eventually we'll make our way up to 3. He is that character, and I believe I mentioned him on one other episode, where he plays this little old counselor who's trying to fuck one of the teenagers.
Yes, and he keeps calling her Sweet Pea.
He's like, hey, Sweet Pea.
I literally just watched the trilogy, like, a few days ago, and it's just so disgusting, because when they're in the mess hall, she's, like, flirting with him, and he grabs his Playboy belt buckle, and I'm like, yep. He's like, Sweet Pea, you don't have to go. Daddy says you don't have to go fishing if you don't want to, Sweet Pea.
Exactly. I think we're gonna have fun with that when we get to it.
Yep.
But he was also in another one in Tales from the Crypt. He was in Came the Dawn, which is a episode about someone with split personalities. Then we have the professor, played by Jake McKinnon. He's in a lot of good stuff. He's in Puppet Master 4 and 5. He was in Trancers 4, The Outer Limits, From Dusk Till Dawn, Wishmaster, Xena, Ginger Snaps 2 and 3, Land of the Dead, Halloween 2. Like, he's all over the board. And then we have Dr. Satan, played by, I'm probably going to say his name wrong, but Walter Phelan, or Phelan? I'm not sure how to say that. But he was also in From Dusk Till Dawn, Wishmaster, Charmed, The X-Files, and Masters of Horror, The Fair-Haired Child. And last but not least, we have Don Willis, played by Harrison Young, Taxi Driver, Waxworks 2, Lost in Time, Humanoids from the Deep, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Saving Private Ryan, and one that we will have on the show. I know I keep saying that, but Bubba Hotep. We will find a way to get that on here. Bruce Campbell fights a mummy. Come on.
Yep.
So for anyone that hasn't seen this movie, the basic premise is that four friends are on a cross-country road trip to write a guidebook about, like, the offbeat attractions you find, you know, when you're going cross-country. One stop leads them to learn about a little local legend called Dr. Satan, and in their search for answers, they wind up as prisoners of a sadistic family in the House of a Thousand Corpses. Mwahaha. So, we open up with this great, like, television clip of Dr. Wolfenstein's creature feature show, like, you know, old horror host kind of thing. And then we cut to a commercial for Captain Spaulding's Museum of Hospice and Mad Men.
I love it. Howdy, folks. You like blood, violence, freaks of nature? Well, then come on down to Captain Spaulding's Museum of Monsters and Mad Men. See the alligator boy. Ride my famous murder rod. Most of all, don't forget to take home some of my tasty fried chicken. It just tastes so damn good. And then he goes, bawk, 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 bawk.
Exactly. And I remember seeing that in the theater and like the whole crowd just cackling at that part. And then, of course, oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I love that opening. I like the Wolfenstein thing because that being said, like if things don't click in the movie exactly, it really doesn't lie to you ever, which is what I love about some Rob Zombie movies. And I think a lot of critics can maybe take shots at him for is that it does look gimmicky or cheap in a way. Like I think Maurice mentioned, oh, people compare it to Texas Chainsaw. And I would say especially like Texas Chainsaw 2.
Yep.
But I think everything works about it. Like the movie is called House of a Thousand Corpses and it opens with, you know, Elvira, like a host right there, like just telling you out of the gate what is going to happen. So I don't think it justifies, you know, some of the disconnects, but I definitely feel like that's one of the appeals for me. And then cut to as if you were watching a horror movie, there's a commercial break and it's, of course, you know, one of the characters and stuff. So that works for me a lot.
And, you know, and this is something we will actually circle back to when we cover our fourth movie this month with 31, because that was one that was really like lambasted by the critics for being exactly what he promised it to be. You know, he didn't lie. He didn't pull no punches. He was like, here's what my movie's about. And then people were like, it was about this and I didn't like it. It's like, but he told you it was about that. You knew
but
going
I said.
In.
Yeah. No, that's the one I love 31. I like it a lot. I think it's great. And
I'm right there with you.
We can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, that's I know we're getting ahead of ourselves, but yeah, I can't wait to talk about that either.
Well, here's my 31 story. I was pretty unsure that it was going to make the cut. I figure if anything, it'd be House of a Thousand Corpses only, but I had just watched it before we announced the picks. So I'll be watching that movie twice this month.
There's nothing wrong with that.
And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I honestly, I watch it every Halloween since it's come out. So, but anyway, so we cut to the actual Captain Spaulding's Museum of Monsters and Madmen. We see the sheriff outside gassing up his car and feeding some old hound dog some chicken. And this is viewed from across the street in the bushes. And then we see a title card that says October 30th, 1977. Inside, we meet Stucky and Captain Spaulding. And Stucky is bitching to Spaulding about a signed nudie photo and how he can't sell it because it's personalized to him. He was going to sell it to Jackie Cobb. And he goes on to tell him about how this guy is a strange cat. He likes to twirl a sharpened pencil, right next to his eyeball. And Spaulding tells me, he goes, he's been sticking that pencil somewhere else. And he goes, nah, he doesn't do anything like that. Although this one time he did get a Planet of the Apes doll stuck up his ass. He goes on to say he had to go to the hospital because Dr. Zaius was hanging half out of his asshole. I was like, that's just the most random. Here's the thing. We always talk about the I like cheese dialogue where it's random filler dialogue. The filler dialogue in this movie is fucking hilarious.
Yeah. And it looks so natural. Like, just like two buddies talking about ridiculous shit and then laughing about it.
Right.
And then, Captain Spaulding's bow tie. I fucking love it.
Oh, it's a little skull. Yep.
Yeah, so now it definitely helps. The actors, I think, are phenomenal. And I think Michael Pollard and Sid Haig, because I think it can really, they can help. I feel like in some of Rob Zombie's movies, when you have like younger or fresher actors, there's very few of his movies where they are like non-seasoned actors.
Yeah,
it feels a little stilted sometimes, but like this, I thought it was just a good rapport.
Oh, absolutely. But then we cut to we cut back outside and we see the cop leaving, and then we see a POV shot from the bushes kind of watching across the street. Cut back inside real quick and Stucky goes to the bathroom, and Spaulding basically tells him he better not clog up the shitter again with paper towels. And he goes off to the bathroom.
He says, you bust that toilet, I'll bust your ass.
And then he pulls down the little bow tie you were talking about, and he goes, yeah. But then, yeah, we cut across the street again. We see the POV camera rush the door. Doors bust open. We see two robbers come in. And they Spalding is less than impressed. They tell him to put his hands up. He puts his hands up with both middle fingers, which I found fucking hilarious. Then the one robber yells to his partner to get the asshole out of the crapper. And he turns and addresses Spalding. He says, "All right, Pippi, hand over the cash box and I might leave your brains inside your skull." And Spalding responds with, "Well, I'll tell you what, Ski King," because he's got a ski mask on. "Why don't you just take your mama home some fried chicken and I won't have to stuff my boot all up in your ass." I love Spalding.
Yes.
And he goes, "I don't like chicken and I hate clowns." And then Spalding just growls at him.
Well, I like what he says when they first bust in. He's like, "Harry fucking Moses."
He goes, "You all get the fuck out of here." So we see the second robber and Stucky coming out of the bathroom. And the robber is carrying Stucky stuff for him. And the other guy gets pissed. He's like, "Would you put that shit down?" And he shoots the ceiling and all this plaster falls on his head. And he gets pissed off, points at Spalding and goes, "That's it. I'm going to count to 10 and you're going to hand over the cash box or I'm going to splatter your grease paint mug all across the state line." And he goes, "1. And Spalding goes, "Fuck your mama." He goes, 2. "Fuck your sister." And then Stucky recognizes the other robber and goes, "Hey, don't I know you? Don't you work at the hardware store? Richard Wick, right?" And then he goes, 3, "Fuck your grandma."
He goes, "Yeah, they even made a song about you. Little Dick Wick played with his prick. Don't his smell just make you sick?"
And then he gets all rattled. He's like, "Stop singing that song. I hate that song." And he pulls his mask off. And then the other guy yells, "Put your damn mask on." And he fumbles and drops it. So then Spalding starts laughing. The robber, you know, basically says, "Fuck it." Turns and points the gun at Spalding, and then Ravelli just busts in with his fucking sledgehammer and that giant bobblehead mask he wears and clobbers the robber in the face with a sledgehammer. Spalding pulls a gun, shoots the other guy dead, and, you know, then he sniffs the barrel, which is just, it's weird, but also kind of awesome.
It's a Captain Spalding thing to do.
Yeah, he just...
I think it's very... keeping with his character, like, mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen Three from Hell and
oh yeah,
Devil's Rejects we were just talking about, but like, I feel like I never felt, and maybe even like the pencil thing is kind of an indicator, I don't know, I never felt like Spalding was like a straight up like Charles Manson sociopath, like he's definitely like a killer,
right? But
I felt like when he talks about John Wayne, mm-hmm. he's definitely more cut in the Three from Hell Wild Bunch vein. It seems like he's definitely killed people, but I feel like he's probably done it for just probably for fun sometimes, but not like statistically, like, you know, tearing fathers' faces off and putting them on their own faces. Yeah.
Not like the Firefly family. Like,
right, right. He definitely seems like distant from that. And he's, I don't know.
The sanest of that bunch.
Right.
Yeah. Like I don't think he'd ever like really revel in it too much, but like the gun sniff, that's more of what he would revel in. Like, I can't explain it, but it's less like, I don't know, like a getting off on body parts kind of thing.
Oh yeah. No, it definitely makes sense to his character. But then I love it because he comes around the corner or comes around the counter and he steps on the robber who's still alive, points the gun in his face. And then we see a POV shot looking up at Spalding and he says, "And most of all, fuck you." And then he shoots 3 times at the camera. Screen goes black and he goes, "Motherfucker got blood all over my best clown suit." And then we get the opening credits, which is basically a Rob Zombie music video. Not that, yep, I'm complaining, but, you know.
With the song House of a Thousand Corpses playing.
Yep. And then we cut to a lonely road at night. We see a pickup truck driving through frame with a billboard that says God is dead. And it has loudspeakers playing a message that says, "How many of you want to be touched this afternoon? Raise your hand if you want God to touch you. I'm going to pray that God gives you a divine touch." Like, this is all just kind of like setting up the world that we're in with this movie. Like, it's just everything is strange and offbeat. And then we cut inside. We see a car pass by. We cut inside the car, and we meet our group. So we meet Jerry and Bill first. Jerry is looking at an article about the Manson family and comments how some of the girls are really fucking hot. Jerry's a weird cat.
Yep.
Then Bill notices they're almost on empty and argues with Jerry. He's like, how much did you put in? He goes, I don't know, a couple of bucks. He goes, a couple of bucks? I told you to fill it up. He goes, what am I made of money? He starts arguing with them back and forth. They see a sign for Spalding's and head there for gas. He's like, see, there we go. Gasoline and fried chicken. He goes, you didn't have to freak out. I love Jerry's such a lovable asshole in this.
He movie. Is.
So they go to Spalding's. Bill is filling up the car. And he tells Jerry to go inside and check it out and see if it's worth, you know, writing about. And he's like, okay, Mr. Cranky. He goes inside and comes out in like 2 seconds. He's like, dude, it's fucking boss. We got to go in. He's like, how, boss? He goes, like, wake up the girls, boss. He goes, yeah, hell yeah. So they wake up the girls and go in. I'm sorry. Before that, we get the first of Mary's weird dream sequences. We see, and every time we see her dream, it's like an inverted camera. So we see this creepy old farmhouse and this weird Grim Reaper decoration kind of like bobbing back and forth in the breeze. And then the camera zooms in on its face and Jerry wakes her up by pounding on the window of the car, yelling wakey, wakey, eggs and bakey, which I still to this day do every time I got to wake up Jess. I'm sure she's pissed about it, but, you know, fuck it.
Marriage.
Yeah, she stuck with me. So Denise wakes up Mary, who's also very annoyed, but they go to check it out. So inside we see Spalding is just finishing mopping up the blood, and the group goes and looks at all the oddities. Bill and Jerry clearly love what they see, and then Bill tries to interview Spalding. Now this is what you were talking about, where he's talking about John Wayne, how much he loves him and all that. He has got the John Wayne tattoo. Basically Spalding kind of fucks with Bill a little bit, making him think, you know, that he doesn't like him. He's like, you all think we're a bunch of hicks, or I forgot how he said it, but he basically made Bill think he's getting pissed off, and Bill starts stuttering, and he's just like, gotcha. He goes, oh, you're such a bad clown.
He says, y'all think us folk from the country's real funny, like, don't ya? Well, yeah, well, saddle up the mule, ma, slide me some grits. I got to get me some education. And then Bill's getting upset, and he's like, Jerry, and Spalding's like, gotcha.
That's right.
Yeah.
So he goes on about, like, you know, how long he's run the place and all that. And they find out about the murder ride, so they decide they're going to take the tour. And Bill and Jerry are pretty excited. Mary and Denise seem very annoyed. And then we get the murder ride montage. Now, there's little vignettes. We see, like, an Albert Fish vignette, Ed Gein, and then finally S. Quentin Quarry, a.k.a. Dr. Satan. And Spalding gives a Dr. Satan backstory. He talks about how he was an intern at the Willows County Mental Hospital, nicknamed Weeping Willows for the never-ending cries of pain, and that Dr. Satan thought he could create a race of superhumans through experimental brain surgery on the mentally ill. The townsfolk found out about his little experiments, and vigilante justice prevailed. They dragged him out to an old tree and hung him. And he tells him that very tree is just a stone's throw away from here. And he tells him, however, the next day, his body was found missing, and no trace of him has ever been seen since. And then he points at Mary, and he goes, maybe he lives next door to you. And he's like, all right, ride's over, get out.
And it's so great, because they walk out, and he tells him, don't forget your complimentary fried chicken. Oh, because Jerry asks, where's the tree?
Right.
And Captain Spalding draws him this little map, and he's like, you go down here, turn left, turn right. If you don't find it, whatever. And then Jerry walks out, and I love this, holds the bag of chicken over his head, and he's like, ah, Dr. Satan! Dr. Satan!
Yep. He was very excited. And I love, on the commentary, Rob Zombie talks about how he always imagined Jerry coming out of a Dr. Satan rock concert. But so we cut to Denise going to call her dad after the ride is over. And we see, like, a shot of the suburbs with trick-or-treating going on. Denise's dad answers the phone, and she tells him about how they're behind schedule. They stopped off at some place called Spalding's, and it's just outside of Ruggsville. So a little, you know, kind of plot point that we need to remember. And then we cut to the news on the television at Mr. Willis's house, and it's the 7 o'clock news with Lance Brockwell, aka Bill Moseley.
yep.
And he says, in our top story tonight, investigators still have no leads in the strange disappearance of five cheerleaders from the Ruggsville High School. Then he says, Cindy Thompson, Karen Murphy, Allison Cole, Valerie Green, and Dawn Baker were last seen 4 days ago leaving a football game. So, you know, they're just outside of Ruggsville. And then we see on the news, some shit's going down in Ruggsville. So we cut to the group driving away looking for the tree. Now it's pouring rain. The girls just want to skip it. Bill seems a little unsure, and Jerry really wants to go. As they're driving along, they see a hitchhiker on the side of the road and decide to pick her up. Now, this is where we first meet Baby Firefly. She tells them that she lives nearby and, you know, she's just up the road a little bit. Jerry asks her if she knows about Dr. Satan and that whole hanging tree. And she's like, oh, yeah, I know where that is. It's right near my house. So they start driving along, you know, looking for it. And we cut to the first of many grainy footage shots of Baby looking at the camera and talking. Now, these were modeled after the Manson Family Home movies, right?
Yes.
That's why I remembered reading that somewhere, that they modeled these little, like, you know, whatever you want to call them, the confessional type things where they're looking at the camera after the Manson Home movies.
It almost felt like it was from a Rob Zombie concert. Like they had like a lot of those clips like came from the background stuff at his shows. So I had just always assumed that it wasn't actually like made for the movie. He had just had that footage already.
Oh no, actually these in the trivia, it does talk about all these interstitials. He shot them at like when they were waiting to be like when the movie was shelved. Rob Zombie kept shooting stuff, hoping that they could release it.
Oh, and, so like Super 8 stuff or just like,
yeah,
60 millimeter or something.
Yeah, he was doing it with his camera.
In his basement. Like he would have different actors come over, like the Ed Gein thing. He had Bill Moseley dress up and they basically shot all that. And then the same thing with like Sherry Moon talking to the camera, doing the whole like dance around with the skeletons and all, like a lot of that was added in after the fact.
That's cool. It definitely adds that feel, that stuff, like the funhouse stuff, like it's weird. For me, it definitely adds to the movie, but then it also like, sometimes I feel like it just, I don't know. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't. It's almost like a detriment, but then it's also like that Wolfenstein feature movie you'd watch.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like it's one of the things that critics probably disliked the most because it does break up the movie. But I don't know. It does have an endearing charm to it. Like, again, it adds to the world that we're in. You know, just like the weird thing with like the pickup truck driving by with the billboard sign, like, what was the point of that? It's just there, but it adds flavor to that, the whole world he's building. But yeah, so we see the first of the grainy camera footage and she's looking at the camera and she says, whatever you need to do, you do it. There's no wrong. If someone needs to be killed, you kill them. That's the way. And then we cut back to them driving along this muddy, overgrown road. And we see in the bushes, we see Rufus wearing a bear head for some reason. And again, just the weird world we're in. And he shoots out one of their tires. The group freaks out, thinking they hit something and blew a tire. Bill and Jerry get out to change the tire. And Bill tells Jerry it's a good thing he had him fill up the spare before they left. And he goes, what if I forgot to put the spare back in the car? What's plan B? He flips out. He's like, what the fuck, Jerry? And he goes, well, I did what you said, technically. I filled it up. So back in the car, they're all arguing. Baby is fiddling with the radio. Some song she likes comes on. She turns it up and starts dancing around, much to the annoyance of everybody. Bill turns the radio off. Baby gets annoyed and tells him, she's like, God, we can walk to my house from here. It's not far. She goes, my brother has a tow truck. So Bill and Baby head out to the house while Jerry, Denise, and Mary wait for the tow. And on the radio, which I think Jerry turned it back on, we get a little bit of the news talking about the five missing cheerleaders. So again, like more of the missing cheerleader talk. And we cut to, right after they talk about the cheerleaders missing, we cut to another one of those grainy footage shots of Baby swinging a knife and stabbing at the camera while laughing. Then we get a clip of from the movie The Old Dark House, talking about, you know, what if inside all the people are dead with candles burning around them, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's just a little clip from that. And we see the old farmhouse that they're walking to. We zoom inside and we see Otis for the first time giving his deranged speech to the cheerleaders. Now, I didn't write down all of Otis's speeches, but this just gives you an idea of how he talks. He goes, just starts off with, why, you ask? Why is not the question. How? Well, now that's a question worth examining. How could I, being born of such conventional stock, arrive a leader of the rebellion? An escapist from a conformist world, destined to find happiness only in which cannot be explained. I've brought you here for a reason, but unfortunately, you and your sentimental minds are doing me no good. My brain is frozen, locked. I have to break free from this culture of mechanical reproductions and the thick encrustations dying on the surface. He goes, ah, Christ, fuck it. And then we cut away. So he's a fucking Looney Tune.
Yep.
And we cut to Baby and Bill running up to the old farmhouse in the rain. We see tons of Halloween decorations everywhere. And I love the look of this farmhouse. Like, it just, it's the most, like, eclectic, crazy pack rat, like, type of look. And it's all, like, old 60s and 70s Halloween decorations. It just, it's so cool. And we see all these baby dolls pinned up to the wall, all chopped up. And Baby goes on to explain to Bill that she used to cut up her baby dolls and hang them up here. I'm like, yep. Oh, yeah, that's a thing people do. Run, Bill, run. So Baby checks the door, sees it's locked, and says she has to go around back. Bill is clearly spooked. So while he's waiting for, he's looking around and we're zooming in on all the creepy baby dolls. And then we get a baby jump scare. Bill gets pissed off and tells her not to do that. And she goes, oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. And I wrote again, Bill, run.
Right.
Red flag, red flag. So she tells him her brother already left to go get the car. Bill's surprised by, you know, how quickly that happened and that he didn't see a car leave. And well, the reason he didn't see the car leave is because Rufus is already out there. So back at the car, we see Mary kind of freaking out. She keeps hearing something outside, but they can't see because of the sheets of rain coming down on the car. Eventually, they turn on the lights. We see Rufus standing in front of the car. Everyone screams and freaks out. And then Jerry realizes it's the tow truck guy and tells them all to calm down. He hooks up the car and tows them back to the house. Now, back at the house, we see Bill in a new set of clothes while his wet ones are drying.
Farmer Bill.
Right, he's got the overalls and the plaid.
And Baby comes down the stairs in her first costume change, wearing pajama pants that are too small for her, meaning you can just see the top of her ass crack.
Baby butt crack.
And a shirt that looks like she bought one of those, like, looms, like when you're 5 years old. And just, like, took pieces of paper and, like, fashioned it into a shirt. Because you could almost see all of her bits.
Oh, yeah.
And yep. What's wrong with this?
Nothing. Exactly. I've said okay. It many times. She's one of my ultimate girl crushes.
Yeah. And like I said, you got good taste. But he asks if it's just her and her brother here. And she goes, oh, no, there's a bunch of us running around somewhere. She goes, Otis is probably upstairs messing around. And we cut to a scene upstairs of Otis wearing a cheerleader outfit and choking one of the cheerleaders to death while laughing.
Yep.
So it's like, oh. And then she gives him hot cocoa and she's flirting hardcore with him. And I love this because I wrote moose hands.
Right.
Bill looks up and sees the moose head. He goes, oh, he must have been running pretty fast to get his head stuck in the wall like that. And he puts, you know, the moose antlers on the side of his head and goes, Murr. And I was like, yes, moose hands. I know we've explained the origin of that on the show before.
Yes.
But so then Baby steals his glasses and puts them on. He takes a sip of the cocoa and says, ooh, tasty. And she says, it's not the only thing in this house that's tasty.
She goes, and, I mean, the only thing tasty in this house, as she, like, dips her finger in and seductively licks it wearing his glasses.
Right. And now we cut to our third grainy footage shot of topless Baby, I wrote, dem titties, dancing around in fire and cuddling up to skeletons. Now, apparently, this was one of the scenes that they had to really cut a lot from.
Yeah, because she's apparently masturbating with a corpse.
Yes, and apparently they brought it to the climax scene. Like, there was a scene of her orgasming. So, I can understand why the critics would cut that, or why the MPAA would cut that. So, so we got back to Bill, who's clearly uncomfortable. Then the group arrives, and he's like, oh, hey, they're here. And she's like, whoop-de-fucking-do. Then we cut to a scene of the entire group sitting in the living room. Baby is still wearing Bill's glasses, ignoring the group and watching TV. And Denise asks her, can we use your phone? And then Mother Firefly pops up out of nowhere.
And she goes, we ain't got no phone.
Like, I won't lie. The first time I saw that, I jumped because she was just there.
Yeah.
I was like, where the fuck did she come from? But she sits down and starts flirting with Jerry, who's very obviously looking at her tits.
Like,
he's not hiding it. He's just looking right down. Then Mama tells Baby to go and talk to Rufus and find out how long until their truck is going to be, or until their car is going to be fixed. And they kind of end up being a bunch of assholes now. They kind of start teasing Mama about, you know, being a hick.
Yeah.
And so I was like, you know, the whole group is kind of, you're doing stuff you don't do in a horror movie. Like, don't be a dick because it's going to get you killed. And we could tell Mama Firefly is pretty offended at this point, but she still invites them to join her for dinner. And Baby comes back and says that Rufus said it's going to be a couple hours. So we get a montage of the dead cheerleaders. It's just like, we get a lot of like, cutaways from the actual film to just random shots of shit, and this is one of many where it's like, hey, look, dead cheerleaders, and then we use that transition to change to our next set piece where they're all in the dining room and there's like paper mache masks in front of them, and Mary is bitching about it. Now Mary is the real fucking bitch of this movie. Jerry of course is fucking around. He's putting the mask on and like picking its nose and all that. And then we get Tiny comes in the room. And I love this shot because it's just like this shot from like the ceiling down on the group. They're all just looking up. And we see how huge Tiny is. He just comes lumbering into the room and plops down in the chair at the end of the table. And Mama comes in and writes a note for him saying, get Grandpa. And then she goes on to explain to the group that he can't hear so good. And then we get Tiny's backstory. She says that her Earl, her apparently one of her husbands, just went crazy on him one day, and we see the professor for the first time. And she says that he tried to burn the whole house down. That she don't think he meant to hurt him, but you know he went crazy on him and tried to burn the house down. And Tiny was in the basement, so we see Tiny getting burned.
And but it wasn't on purpose.
I'm sorry.
Allegedly, not on purpose.
Wait, I'm sorry, repeat. I was coughing. I didn't hear you.
Oh, I was being sarcastic. I said, but not on purpose.
Ah. And then Susie, what'd you say?
And then she can see the girls are visibly like, ugh. And she goes, oh, my baby boy gets shy around new people, but he'll warm up to you, especially the girls. And then she laughs and she's like, he's a real lady killer.
Womp, womp, womp.
And we see, I love it, because while she's saying that, we see Tiny waking up Grandpa, and how he wakes him up is he just puts his hand on his back and like pushes him up and down on the bed so Grandpa just kind of bounces.
Yep.
And then he wakes up yelling at him like, what the fuck. So now we cut to them sitting down for, or I'm sorry, we cut from there to Baby getting ready while listening to the Ramones and yelling at one of the cheerleaders. This is where we get the whole I know you've
Baby.
Got, yep.
She yells at him about not having any team spirit, and she's got like this little, it looks like a sock monkey.
Right.
Doll. And she gets really pissed and she goes, give me a B. Give me an A. Give me a B. Give me a Y. What's that spell? And the girl like kind of recoils and she goes, what's that spell? And the girl's like, Baby. And she's like, you darn right. And then she like has the sock monkey dance down the girl's leg. She's like, doo, 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 doo. And then you see that the girl who's alive is in bed with a girl who is dead and clearly already starting to decompose.
Mm-hmm.
How does that house not smell?
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure it does.
I haven't.
Yeah.
But I mean, to be fair, it was the 70s. Everything looked dirty.
That's true.
Looked and smelled dirty.
Right. So then we cut back to the group, and Mama tells them that it's time to put on their masks because they can't eat dessert with their everyday faces now, can they? And of course, Mary is a total bitch about it, and Grandpa yells at her. He's like, put the damn thing on or she ain't gonna let any of us eat. And I love it because he steals some food off of her plate.
Watching him eat just really grossed me out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, he was fucking foul.
Not as worse as Tiny eating his cereal later.
Oh my God, that grosses me out. And then we'll get to it at the very end. There's something else that really grosses me out, but definitely Grandpa eating and Tiny and his cereal.
Oh yeah, the slurping. So then Jerry asks them if they know anything about Dr. Satan, and this is where Otis enters the room, carrying a fetus in a jar. And Mama gets all excited. She goes, Otis, you came down. And she goes, and you brought Leroy. And she starts kissing the jar. I was like, oh, that's disturbing.
Yep.
And then I didn't write down all of Otis's dialogue here, but he basically goes on to say, he says, I know all about what you want to know about. And he doesn't want to tell Jerry. And Jerry keeps asking questions. I love it because Grandpa goes, who are you, Jimmy Olsen? What did he say? Cub reporter
for the Daily asshole.
That's what it was. So basically he refuses to tell him. And he goes, boy, I bet you'd stick your head in a fire if I told you could see hell. And then we get a bell rings. And Grandpa stands up and says, ladies and germs, it's showtime. And he spits out all this gobs of food while he's talking. Oh. It's fucking gross. And then we get a weird montage. And this whole scene felt like part of a music video. We get a montage of Grandpa telling a joke on stage while Mama is working the lights, but the joke is all cut apart, so you can't really tell what the fuck he's talking about.
And him, he's just gross. So even that crass and very sexually explicit joke is just so, it makes it even more nasty.
Right. Yeah, because he's talking about eating pussy, and he's just start, like, licking and making all these faces. It's pretty gross. Jerry finds it hilarious, though. The girls look disgusted, and Bill just looks weirded out.
Yep.
And then Grandpa's comes off stage, and Baby comes out.
And, oh my God.
she's lip syncing to a Betty Boop song.
I wanna be loved by you, just you, and nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone. Boop, boop, bee-doop.
I should have been expecting that, but I wasn't.
See, I can still surprise you after all this time.
Yeah.
And she's just like flirting hardcore with Bill. And Mary has just, she's finally had enough. And she yells at her to get off of him. Mm-hmm. And then they have a verbal altercation. And Baby whips out like a switchblade. And she's like, I'm going to cut your tits off and shove them down your throat.
Yep. And then Mama runs over and tries to stop her, and as that's going on, Rufus busts in and says, car's done. She goes, I think it's best if you people leave. And they're like, all right, we're going. And fucking Baby's still holding the knife like she wants to cut him. And then
they walk out, and her and Mama are like cuddling.
Yeah.
And she's like, I love you, Baby. She goes, aw, I love you, Mama.
And then they cackle. They fucking cackle maniacally.
And then all hell fucking breaks loose.
Yeah. Now the group is leaving, and we see them driving down the driveway, and it's raining hard. We see two scarecrows along the side of the driveway, and the gate is closed. So Bill jumps out of the car, and they're like, what are you doing? He's like, I got to open the gate. And as he's going to open the gate, the one scarecrow jumps down, comes up behind Bill, and starts beating the shit out of him with a pipe. So Jerry runs out and tries to stop him. The other scarecrow jumps down. The one that's beating Bill starts whooping on Jerry. And then the other scarecrow picks him up. And now at this point, it's very obvious that that's Otis and Tiny. Mm-hmm. But Tiny, the bigger one, picks up Jerry and body slams him into the car, breaking the windshield. The girls are freaking out. We see Otis continues to beat Bill with a pipe. And then they take off their masks and reveal, obviously, who it is. And then Otis looks in the car and smiles, And Tiny walks up to the car, looks in, wipes the water away, looks at Denise, and then just fucking shatters the window and drags her out.
Right.
Pretty fucking scary.
It's like she goes to lock, reaches over to lock the door, close the door. It's like, do you really think that's going to protect you from these maniacs?
Exactly. Like, at that point, you're just grasping at straws.
Right.
But yeah, so then Denise is getting dragged away by Tiny. Otis jumps up on the car and starts bashing the windshield and screaming, just terrorizing Mary. And then we cut to the next day. Rufus is towing the now destroyed car away, which I had to stop and think about. Again, this is one of those things watching the movie critically. So he shot the tire out to stop them. He then fixed the car just so they could drive a few feet.
Yeah.
And then destroy the car.
It was to give them a sense that they were going to make it out.
Right. I'm just like, is it? I guess to them that's a fun game, but it's like, why? Like, why not just jump them?
Crazy's got a crazy.
I was just going to say, even in the Devil's Rejects, maybe there was a little bit of a plan, but there rarely is, it seems, with them.
That's true. That's a good point.
But not that I know what you're saying, though. It is kind of stupid.
It struck me as odd this watching it this time, you know, trying to pay attention to all the little details. I was like, wait a second. That's why did he fix it if they were just going to destroy? OK, like, but whatever. Movie's got a movie and crazy's got a crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we cut to Mr. Willis calling Sheriff Houston and reporting that his daughter never showed up. He explains that they stopped at a place called Spalding's, and Houston goes, yeah, I know the place. And he goes, well, I'll send some guys to look around. He goes, but it was storming like a son of a bitch. They might be stuck on one of the back roads, like out in the mud. And so he assures Mr. Willis that he'll go and look. Now we cut to Mary waking up. She's seeing flashes of Bill. And then when she fully comes to, we see that she's gagged and wearing a dunce cap.
Which is hilarious.
Right. And she just starts screaming through the gag. Otis starts yelling at her to shut the fuck up because he's trying to work. Now, again, I didn't write down his speech because it's long. But he basically tells her, like, you know, she's never worked a day in her life type of speech. And he tells her, now, I'm going to remove your gag, but if you so much as make a fucking peep, I'm going to cut you like a pig and make you eat your fucking intestines. You got me? I was like, Jesus. And he removes her gag and she asks where Bill is. And he goes on to tell her what a great guy Bill has been, that he was having such a hard time with this mental block, but Bill helped him through it. And we cut to a flashback of grainy footage. So the previous night, we see Bill tied up and bloody. Otis and Baby come into the room. Baby turns on the radio, starts playing Brick House and dancing, while Otis tortures Bill with a razor blade, a straight razor, just chopping him and cutting him. And then he decides to chop his hand off with a hatchet. Then we cut back to Mary begging to see Bill, and he goes, okay. And he turns her around and pulls back a curtain. And he goes, fish boy. It's Bill turned into a Fiji mermaid.
Yep.
I was like, what the fuck?
With his foot sticking out from underneath the mermaid tail.
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw this, like reading it in the script is one thing. But then seeing it on screen, I was like, that's so fucking weird looking. Like, what a crazy death scene for a movie. You know, like, we always talk about, like, the different deaths of characters in these horror films. That's a crazy one. Like, I can't think of another one similar to that.
The human centipede, it
kind
of
reminds me of. I think the human centipede is worse than this. Yeah, they're still alive.
I was just going to say, because they're alive. Oh, yeah. I will forever argue. Oh, God.
No, nothing. Go on.
I was going to say, I will forever argue that first movie is a good movie. Like, it's a legit good movie because it's scary as shit. Like, I get it. The gimmick, you know, the whole, you know, no pun intended by saying shit, but the gimmick not being what it is, like, just the concept of a mad scientist wanting to do this to people is fucking terrifying. And the surgery scene, where he's got them all in beds, like ready to perform surgery on him, and he's explaining what he's going to do to them. It is fucking nightmare fuel. Like, the first time I watched that movie, I was freaked the fuck out. The second and third one are utter garbage. Like, they just, they have no reason to exist other than to be garbage. But that first movie, I feel like Tom Six decided, you know, oh, I'm going to make this shocking movie. And he actually stumbled on making a good movie and then didn't understand why he made a good movie. So he tried to replicate it and only replicated the bad parts. So I don't think he's a good director. I think he just accidentally stumbled into making a good film. But anyway, so we cut back to Fishboy, and Mary starts freaking out, saying, this can't be real, this can't be real. And Otis grabs her and says, oh, it's as real as I want it to be, Mama. And he forces a kiss on her. And she's like, fuck you, you fucking freak. And then it does a smash cut to Ravelli waving in front of Captain Spaulding's while this happy-go-lucky music plays.
Yep.
And this is where we meet Wydell and Nash for the first time. So they go in to question Spaulding. And inside, I love this scene. Wydell is just beating the bell on the counter, just smashing it over and over again. And you hear from the back Spaulding yell, sweet baby Jesus, whoever's jerking off on that bell better be gone by the time I come out or I'm going to rip your nuts off. And then he comes out wearing a t-shirt with an like a drawing of a pig wearing a police hat that says pigs is beautiful. I fucking love that scene. Again, seeing that in the theater, people lost their fucking minds laughing. Like, the whole crowd just erupted. And then, so we get this back and forth where they question him about the missing kids. He explains that he saw them the night before. There's this comment where he goes, he looks at the picture of Denise. He goes, oh, yeah, cute kid. He goes, but, you know, I like him a little bigger. He goes, more cushion, the sweeter to push. And then he starts humping the air, going,
it's so gross.
I love it, though, because Wydell's like, fuck you, clowny. Oh, man. So he makes him draw the map for them that he drew for the kids. And now we cut to the second of Denise's dreams. She's dreaming about an old farmer talking about the skunk ape and how it had impure relations with his wife. She goes, that's true. He performed lurid acts upon me and my person. And then she dreams she's running to a grave, and we see it's the grave of Dr. Satan, and then the grave erupts, and we get a Dr. Satan jump scare. And she wakes up tied up to a bed wearing a baby doll outfit. And now this is where Tiny comes in. This is the cereal scene. He comes walking, and I love it. He's got a t-shirt that just says cheap-ass Halloween costume.
And he's eating Agatha Crispies.
Yes! That was the best joke in the movie, I thought.
I agree, actually. That was fucking hilarious. I want that to be a real cereal. But he pours some in a dog bowl and then offers it to Denise, who turns her head away, and then he proceeds to just slurp the cereal up. It's so fucking gross. And she starts begging him to let her go. And he just, like, reaches over and undoes the restraint while still eating his cereal. And she's like, I'm gonna...
But that's exactly what it sounded like.
It did. Oh. And then she starts to go. She's like, I'm just going to go now. And he just waves goodbye to her while eating his cereal, like completely doesn't care. And she's.
You saw the shirt he was wearing, right?
A cheap ass Halloween costume. Yeah. She starts backing out of the room. And then Otis grabs her, goes, where the fuck do you think you're going? And he throws her in a cage. And, like, bald feral women jump out of piles of laundry and start attacking her.
Right. So, what was all that?
I mean, I guess you need a lot of bodies when it's a house of 1,000 corpses, but it's like, what?
That's true. Fuck? Were they like mutant zombie women, like, being punished? Were they naughty and now they have to sit in the pen in the cage?
Yeah.
Naughty. I mean...
Punish. I have so many questions about that.
I thought it was something like that too, like something out of Blood-Sucking Freaks.
Yes, I hate that movie. But yes, that's what it reminds me of. And you know, that's a good call. I bet that's what he was referencing. Because, I mean, we know Rob Zombie has surely seen Blood-Sucking Freaks probably
times.
Oh, God. I just recently rewatched that too. And I'm like, why the fuck did I watch this? It was because they had it on the last drive-in. So I was watching it for the Joe Bob commentary. But man, I do not like that movie. Anyway, so we get the feral women. Then we cut to the cops checking out the site that Spalding sent them to. They find the smashed up car and call it in. Now we cut back to a tied up Jerry. And I thought of you, Maurice, because he's in front of this like wall size poster of the creature from the Black Lagoon, which
I want that.
I know, right? Have an entire wall painted like that poster. That would be so fucking cool. But he's tied up and Baby kicks on the door and goes, "Hey there, poopy pants. What's new?" That cracked me up. But so she wants to play a guessing game with Jerry. He tells her to fuck off and she starts chopping off his hair. So finally he agrees to play the game and she tells him that if you get it right, you get to walk out of here, but get it wrong and you're fucked. And she goes, "Who's my favorite movie star?" And he goes, "Marilyn Monroe." And she goes,
"Wrong. Nope. It's Betty Davis." And then she just starts cackling and grabs a chunk of his hair and starts scalping him.
Right. And it was, oh my God, like it looked gross as shit when she was peeling it up from the back like that.
Uh-huh.
Like she was taking his fucking scalp off. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, every time I see that in a movie, I'm like, that's so fucking painful. But so we cut back to the cops and they're standing there with the sheriff. Now, the sheriff asks him if they found anything yet. And Nash is digging through the car and he finds the keys and he holds them up. And I love this because the sheriff goes, "Well, don't just stand there like some prized dog dick. Open the trunk." That's such a great line.
It is. And there we find a naked, mutilated body of one of the cheerleaders.
Yep, with trick or treat carved into her flesh. I was like, oof, that's pretty fucked up.
Yep.
Then we cut back to Otis and Grandpa watching the Munsters. Otis is hucking knives at a tied up, barely conscious Jerry. And Grandpa's just yelling at the TV, you know, like you're apt to do.
Eating and still like spitting shit out of his mouth.
Yep. And then we cut back to Wydell and Nash, who are waiting for Mr. Willis, who is supposed to go on or supposed to ride along with them while they search for his daughter. So Willis gets there. They all get in the car and they take off. Now we get one of those little interstitial weird scenes of a man named Louis Dover.
Harbinger of doom.
Yes, he totally is. Because he's yelling about how you don't have to go to hell to see the devil. He's like, this is hell. This is hell. And he's just screaming. It's like,
and you believe him.
Yeah. Yeah, he dude has definitely seen the devil. But
so I believe him.
Yeah. But so we cut to the cops going up to the Firefly house. When Mr. Willis first showed up, they say that they have a few leads and they're gonna go to the nearby farmhouses. And then we cut to them arriving at the Firefly house. Wydell is gonna go to the door and he tells Nash and Willis to go look around back. So inside we see Mama come running up and get Otis and tells him the cops are outside. He gives her a gun, tells her to play nice.
The police!
Right. And she's like, what are we going to do? He goes, well, you go downstairs and play nice. And he goes, and I'll go take care of the rest like I always fucking do.
And he like gets in Grandpa's face as he says it.
Right. And I love it because Hugo just sticks his finger up and middle finger.
And like, keeps watching the Munsters.
Yep. So now Wydell knocks on the door. Mama answers, starts to flirt with him a bit. And he convinces her to let him in so they could talk about the missing kids. Around back, Nash and Willis are kind of looking around the crazy property, talking about, like, you know, they're a bunch of pack rats, and we get a dog jump scare. And I love it because it really freaks Nash out. And that he's talking about how much he hates dogs because, was it a Cocker Spaniel?
I think it was a Cocker Spaniel that bit him.
I was 8 years old.
He's like, it was a big fucking Cocker Spaniel, too. But while searching, they hear these muffled cries coming from a metal shed. Now, Nash and Willis try to break the shed open, and then we cue the song, I Remember You, and we get this slow motion sequence. They bust the door open. We see Mary tied up and brutalized amidst the corpses of a bunch of cheerleaders. Willis freaks. Nash calls Wydell. We see inside Wydell turned to answer his radio. Mama pulls the gun and shoots him in the head. So Wydell falls down dead. We cut back outside. We see Willis trying to run away. And he gets this momentary flashback. Now, this is pretty sad. He gets this momentary flashback of Denise, him, and his wife, like, at Christmas time. And then, boom, we see his chest blow out as he's just shot. And he falls down dead in a puddle. Nash looks around terrified. Otis comes out of the bushes holding a gun on him, forces Nash to drop his gun and get on his knees. And now we get this insanely long, 26-second long pause.
But it's such a great scene because it builds the tension so well. Because the music stops.
Yep.
I hate that scene.
Oh, I love it. I love it for that reason because it's so uncomfortable. It's like you.
That's why I hate it.
Oh, it's so well done. I remember seeing it in the theater, and the best part about this scene was the uncomfortable, nervous laughter. Like, you could tell, like, it was that type of laughter where people were like, they didn't know if they should laugh or not. Mm-hmm. And people were, like, genuinely disturbed. And then finally he fucking pulls the trigger. You see him get shot in the head. We hear just the echo of the gunshot, and it pans out as Nash falls down dead. That's great fucking scene.
Yeah, I agree. I do remember that too. Now that you mention that, I remember people kind of like giggling after that. And it reminds me when I saw Three from Hell, there was people like some certain people like laughing in the audience, like at stuff like that. And that's where maybe I don't think everything he wants to do in this movie always works, because you are mixing that sort of like what he was doing in like in the Halloweens, which he's like just flat out said, like, he's not being subtle about it. He's like, well, if there really was like Michael Myers, there'd be so much trauma and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that I feel like that scene, even though it pans like to like a, you know, a bird's view in the tree, like, it really kind of, I felt like rewatching it, it was almost from the point of view of the Walter Goggins character. Like,
right.
Just like, when is this going to happen? Is this going to happen? And like you said, it builds that tension. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a tension of whether or not he's going to get shot, but just the tension of when it's going to happen.
Yep.
And I think it's really well done. But yeah, I think there's that sort of conflicted stuff where we're, you know, kind of joking with the characters that are purely evil, but then suddenly, like, this is where I've heard some critics touch on this too. Like, have you ever heard of the film critic Scott Tafoya? I'm probably butchering his name, but he's on RogerEbert.com and he does this film series called The Unloved.
Okay.
And he looks at movies that were panned or just made no money or destroyed a director's career or whatever, just got buried. And he does have an affinity for horror movies. And he's talked about in Rob Zombie's movies, like the sort of pain and trauma, especially leveled like at women and stuff. But there is, I think, a consideration. I agree with him on that, that there is this consideration for the victim more often in Rob Zombie movies than, like, obviously the movie centered around like serial killers and stuff, but also that sort of loneliness and futility and trauma and just trying to live through it at the same time than a lot of other horror movies. But I do feel like in this one, it's kind of especially buried, but it is there. And that scene is a good example.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you on that. I do really like this type of sequence in a horror movie like this, because it kind of reminds you that, like, it's not okay. Like, I know we've mentioned this before on the show, but like in action movies, there is, you know, people die. It's a dime a dozen. Like, no one gives a fuck. There's like no lasting effects when people die. In a horror movie, there's some gravity to the situation. I mean, granted, not always. I mean, look at a lot of slasher films. It's just a body count. But then there are movies like this, or like Texas Chainsaw, where each person that dies, you kind of feel it, you know, and it's, I like that about horror, because it doesn't minimize death, you know, it actually makes you think about it. And I feel like a scene like this does that super well, because you know it's coming, you know it's going to happen. You have this moment of empathy where you're like, oh my God, how would I feel in that situation, or this poor man? And then it happens and you cringe, you know, you kind of jump back. And yeah. I think it was wonderfully done. Like, I fucking love that scene for all the wrong reasons. You know, it's like, I love it because it upsets me.
Right.
Yeah. I will forever give Rob Zombie that, because he really kills it with that in The Devil's Rejects, which I know one day we will do. But man, that movie, like, when I finished watching that movie, I couldn't fucking move the first time. Like, I was glued to my seat. Like, the credits rolled, and I sat there in the theater, like, not being able to get up. I felt numb and empty. Like, it's just such an experience. And certain directors can pull that off well.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just, and it's funny, because I think I brought this up on the, I know these movies are, like, on the opposite ends of the globe. But like the I Know What You Did Last Summer one, and it's funny because I'm pretty sure Rob Zombie named I Know What You Did Last Summer as one of his most hated movies in the world, in a magazine. But I agree with that film critic too, Scott Tafoya. You guys should check him out. I think you guys would enjoy his commentary on Rob Zombie. He pays attention. Like, even the kids in this movie, even though they're on screen for 5 minutes and they're instantly like revulsed, like, I wouldn't say they're revulsed. Like, I think he really does pay attention, even though he knows he's going to kill them or mutilate them, like, to how a person would actually react mm-hmm. in this situation. Like, the girls, you know, if they woke up and their boyfriends were like, hey, we're going to go to this, like, you know, freak show or whatever, they'd be like, no, like, why would we want to do this in the middle of the night? Like, it's, I don't know. It's well done, I think, yeah. more so than other movies. I know it all seems obvious, but it's, I think he does it well.
No, I completely agree. And I feel like that's something he really doesn't get credit for.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, he just, I don't know. It seems trendy nowadays to hate on Rob Zombie movies. I feel like after The Devil's Rejects, it was like everything he's made, it's been trendy to hate on, you know, and maybe that's because his next movie was a remake and it's trendy to hate on remakes. But I know the Halloween, you know, Halloween remake and then the sequel to Halloween, people fucking loathe. And then Lords of Salem, I always heard the same complaint, like, oh, it was a mess of a movie. And it's like, well,
oh, I like that. Yeah.
I love Lords of Salem.
Same. Yeah, definitely. I remember, and I've told this story on this podcast, is when me and Maurice saw it in the theater, I think we were the only two people in that theater that were like, that was fucking awesome. Like, everybody else was like, it was fucking stupid. What the hell? And we were like, what are they talking about? This was great. You know?
Yeah.
So, and I mean, I've legit enjoyed every film I've seen by the man. Like, I remember when 31 came out, everyone just panned the fuck out of it, and I thought it was great. And then even Three from Hell, like, when me and Reese saw it in the theater, the thing I kept hearing about Three from Hell, and I know I'm way off topic here, but it drove me fucking mad, as everyone was like, well, you know, the main characters are terrible. You know, they're horrible, and they're like, you know, they're doing all this bad stuff. It's like, yeah, no shit. You're not supposed to like them. They're the villains. Like, just because they're the main characters don't mean they're who you're supposed to root for. Like, they're, it's a story from the villain's perspective.
Like, right.
You're not supposed to like these guys. They are the bad guys. But it was like people couldn't grasp that concept, and it drove me mad, because I'm like, if you're going into it wanting to root for the main characters, then of course it's going to be off-putting to you. But if you're going into it knowing that they're bad, then you're going to like it.
So what about the people who like the you know, the Jeffrey Dahmer movies and stuff? It's like, they're not exactly heroes.
Right.
Or the good person, but they still like the movie. So that doesn't make any sense at all.
I feel like sometimes people have a hard time enjoying a story from a villain's perspective. You know, like, it's hard for them to, because you're so used to empathizing or identifying with the lead character. Like, most movies are a hero's journey. You know, it's whether it's a romance, an action movie, you know, a horror movie, there's always a good character that you're going to recognize or empathize with. I mean, hell, it's why we have the final girl in slasher movies. They're the hero. But with, you know, something like Three from Hell, there are no heroes. Everyone's bad. even the bad guys that the bad guys are fighting are bad. Like, everybody's bad. There are no the people that are incarcerating the three from hell are bad. Everybody's bad. And I think that was hard for people to swallow.
And the titles, and that's where I think he got. I mean, he is a huge rock star, but I think he got, especially on people's, like, on the internet board, like Nerd Radar and Critic Radar, when he did the Halloweens.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was super quick. And even me, like, I was kind of like, whoa, when, you know, there was that sort of like violent sort of poor kind of trashy family aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
And he put that in the Halloween movies. And then everyone was like, you know, what? This is not Halloween. And but I feel like his other movies, when you look at the titles, like it's you can kind of see. I mean, his name is Rob Zombie. You can kind of I don't know. I feel like you know what you're going to get into or get out of it. And like, not that can't like justify the whole movie, but like just now, like working itself out in my head over this movie in particular, when I rewatched it, I was kind of like, well, some of this works. Like I can see what was maybe being pressed or gone for, but like, anyways, back to the headshot thing, like that works.
Oh, hell yeah.
Like other aspects don't, but, I kind of just lost my train of thought. I was just talking and completely went off the rails.
It's okay. We do it all the time.
Probably like a scene in the movie, but yeah, no, I really like the stuff that he does and the thought and attention he pays to. I would say sometimes the art direction is what draws people to these movies, especially like something like this. Mm. And like, but he still pays a lot of attention to so many auxiliary things, which makes a movie alive.
And
that's what I think ultimately probably makes it worse, even though he has like rando shots from his basement in it.
Right. No, it's he definitely doesn't get enough credit for what he does. But I was like, we should probably get back on track because I just realized I was like, wow, we were off.
Sorry.
No. Hey, I was, this is what I said back with, I Know What You Did Last Summer. I love these kind of conversations. Yep. So I'm totally all in for it. But yeah, so after the awesome, you know, 26 second shot, we do a smash cut to later that night at Red Hot Pussy Liquors.
Oh, I love this scene. And baby, and the song Pussy Liquor is playing as baby walks. Well, no, she doesn't walk. She saunters.
Yep. That's
in
I have my notes.
Her totally ripped up jeans, like ass only covered by the thong strap.
Yep.
Walks in and right away starts like making fun of, I don't even know how to correctly explain it, but he thinks that she's flirting with him and she's really making, yeah. And he's like, let me take a guess here. Y'all are having a Halloween party tonight, huh? And she's like, now what makes you think that, big boy? And then he tells him, like, you're buying a whole lot of holy water. And the baby goes, yeah, we like to get fucked up and do fucked up shit. You know what I mean? And then he does this, like, nervous giggle. Like, he's thinking, oh, my God, she's into me.
Right.
He goes, I like to get fucked up, too, and do some fucked up shit. And she's like,
yeah,
bet you do. And then she goes, so how much we owe you, Goober? And then he gets embarrassed. And he's like, oh, that's supposed to be G. Ober for Jerry Ober. But Carl went and put an extra O, made it Goober, fucking asshole. And then baby's like, this is baby's way of saying, great story, bro. She's like, great story, Goober. How much do we owe you?
Right. He's like, the damage is quite severe. It's $187 or something like that.
And she goes, ain't gonna break my bank, hun. Here, keep the change. Go buy yourself a new name, Goober. And then she saunters back out with Rufus. I fucking love that scene.
The best part is Goober is wearing a mesh shirt. He's a big dude. He's got a mesh shirt on with a name tag pinned to it. It's like, oh, okay. But, oh, where were we? Yeah, so they saunter back out, and then we get a montage of Otis making his skin costume. And we see the family all dressed up for Halloween. The group are in bunny costumes and tied up in the middle of the living room. And Otis comes downstairs wearing Mr. Willis's skin. Now, he's wearing a robe as well, so it's kind of hard to tell. But he says, "I'm the one who brings the Christmas candy. Now tell me, who's your daddy?" And then he walks down another step and he says, "I'm the one who brings the devil's brandy." And then Baby yells out, "Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?"
He goes, "I'm the one that beats you when you're bad." And then we get the
Mama, "Who's your daddy?"
Right. And then Otis walks up to Denise and she sees flashes of her dad. And then he goes, "Come on, sweetie, give daddy some sugar," which is fucking disgusting. And then he leans forward and licks her through the skin mask.
And he holds it back so it doesn't fall off.
Yeah. And then he throws the cloak off and reveals the skinned dad costume. And he goes, "And I'm the one that loves you when you're fucking dead." And Denise freaks out. And this is where they're all laughing at her screaming. And he turns to Jerry and he kind of starts taunting him and tells him, he's like, "Aren't you the one that wanted to meet Dr. Satan?" He goes, "Well, I'm going to do you a favor, boy. I'm going to let you meet him." And then he pulls the skin face off and he goes, "It's all true. The boogeyman is real and you found him." And then we cut to the group marching through this field, like big empty field, to a big pulley system. And we see Tiny start cranking the pulley and pulls this giant coffin out of a hole in the ground. And then Baby tells Otis to remove their gags because it's so much more fun with the screaming. And Mama's like, "Ooh, I like that too, all the screaming." And so they pull the gags out and Jerry starts begging for his life. And they start mocking him. Then Mama kisses him goodbye and Rufus picks him up and body slams him into the coffin. Mary makes a break for it. Otis goes to shoot her, but Baby's like, "No, let me catch her. Let me get her." And he goes, "Oh, all right, fine, go."
This scene, this chase scene is so fucking creepy.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It's like there's all the crosses, so you think maybe it's probably a graveyard or something. And Mary, she's just running for her goddamn life. And Baby's just, it's like that whole, the killer is walking, because she had a good length ahead of Baby before she took off. And Baby starts telling this story. Mm-hmm. About there once was a woman. I don't remember the whole thing, but it was once there was a.
Down.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, right before that, before she trips into the graveyard, we get the grainy footage of Otis talking at the camera. And he goes, "Hunting humans ain't nothing but nothing. Because y'all run like scared little rabbits." And he looks at the camera and goes, "Run, rabbit, run. Run, rabbit." And he starts screaming, "Run, rabbit, run." It's just fucking creepy as hell. And then we cut to Mary running in the rabbit costume and she trips into the graveyard that you were talking about. And we hear Baby from nearby reciting, "There once was a woman who lived with her daughter in a cabbage garden. Along came a rabbit and ate up all of the cabbages. The woman said, 'Go into the garden and drive out the rabbit.'" And then you hear her going, "Mary," like taunting her. It's so eerie.
Yeah.
And then
Mary.
Ugh. And then and Mary's panicking. And then out of nowhere, Baby tackles her.
Oh, my God. I love this part. It's so fucking great because she just starts stabbing the shit out of her. And then she goes, "Shoo, shoo," said the maiden.
Mm-hmm.
"Come, maiden," said the rabbit. "Sit on my tail and go with me to my rabbit hutch." And she's like spitting blood out of her mouth that's like flying up from Mary. And tackles and licks the knife.
Yep. Oh, that the licking the knife, that was like the cincher. You know, it's like just having that little moment right before they cut away. It's like, fuck, she's nuts.
Yeah.
Then we cut back to Denise and Jerry in the coffin. And I love it because as they're sealing them in, Otis goes, "No hanky panky," just out of nowhere. And so they start lowering them down into the hole.
Now. The thing that's playing, and I didn't write down what the quote is, but it's an Aleister Crowley quote.
Yes, it's they cue up this cassette tape that's connected to a lantern and a rope, and they start lowering that down in the hole after them. And it's I did write it down. Let me quickly jump over there. Where is my trivia section? Oh, crap. I know I have it in here. Yeah. It's an Aleister Crowley quote saying, "Bury me in a nameless grave." It's a quote. It's the opening line from his poem, The Poet, recorded in 1920. So they're playing that line on a loop and all distorted.
And do you know what the subtitle said as they were being lowered down?
Gibberish.
Dr. Satan music, zombie monster, wake up music.
And it's not wrong.
Exactly.
We see a montage of zombie people, and then they suddenly attack the coffin and tear it apart. Now, Denise is screaming bloody murder. The zombies grab Jerry and take him away. And now this part I found interesting, because I feel like this is a leftover remnant from the original cut. Because I never noticed this before, but if you have the subtitles on, Jerry is yelling in the distance, "It's eating me."
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's now, cool.
That is something that from the original cut, because they were zombies, and that's not how Jerry meets his demise in this. So I found that interesting. But Denise starts wandering the corridors, and we see something approaching her. It's an old man in a bunny costume. And she starts backing away, and he's like slowly coming closer and closer. And eventually she backs up into another old man, and they just start tearing at her bunny costume, ripping it off. And then once they both get parts of the costume, they wander away.
Because they have to wash it now so it's proper dirty, yet not tainted with a victim for next year.
Ah, yes. Good point. So then we cut up top to Rufus joyriding around in the cop car and drinking. And we see Otis, Baby, and Tiny putting Mary on a giant funeral pyre. And then I just wrote, Denise finds the mummy tunnel. Because it's like... this long tunnel filled with corpses. And she slowly makes her way down it and like keeps bumping into corpses and screaming.
And then, I really like, there's one shot where she's standing in the corridor and it's like a close up of her face with like her eye. It's only a half shot of her face.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can see the long hallway and she's just like looking terrified.
Yeah, they do a lot of cool. That's one thing we didn't mention earlier. They do a lot of cool split screen work in this.
Yeah.
Movie. And that's going to play another role coming up. But we first saw that in the dance sequence with Baby doing the Betty Boop song. But there's a lot of fun split screen. So she slowly makes her way down the corridor and we see a giant set of doors. She slowly opens up the doors and we see a room decorated in bones. It's got like a bone chandelier. There's skulls in the walls. It's just like completely filled with bones. And I wrote, suddenly a member of Slipknot appears and yanks a rope leading to Dr. Satan's waiting room.
That's so true.
Because there's like a dude, he seriously looked like one of the guys from Slipknot, just starts yanking this rope and pulls the door open.
And then, she found Dr. Satan's office and the doctor is in.
Yes, he is. And we see all sorts of like crazies wearing like headgear and like shoveling like pudding in their mouth. It was so fucking gross.
I'm sorry, I lied. There's four parts that really gross me out. This is three.
I know what the next one is.
Yeah, we'll get to it in a minute. Let's just.
So she sees, and then she sees all these people like they're watching random televisions and all that, and they all stop and look at her, and we hear a drilling sound. She looks up. We see a close-up on Jerry's face gurgling blood. We pan out slightly and see he's tied to an operating table. And then we finally fully pan out and we see Dr. Satan for the first time, who looks like a zombie crossed with a robot vulture.
Yep. Like,
he's doing bird-type movements, but he's got this weird like mechanical apparatus connected to his arms that's connected to the ceiling.
It's like, probably what keeps him alive. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of had like almost like a Rasputin kind of quality. Because, you know, there was that whole story about Rasputin like hanging himself from like hooks doing the suspension. That's kind of how I pictured it. It was like he was suspended by those weird cords. Because the way he was moving it was like there was a lot of like shoulder movement. Like that was wiggling him around. But Mary freaks out. He starts speaking gibberish. And then we see the fucking professor come walking out for the first time.
Looking like My Bloody Valentine on steroids.
Right? And he looks down and we see, like, again, here's the split screen, but it's this time it's both of his lenses. Like, he's got these goggles on and, like, he's like, he looks like a fucking peeled tomato. Like, he's.
It reminded me of, like, a Clive Barker character.
Yes.
Yes. He was very much like a Cenobite. Very much. Actually, both of these guys remind me of Cenobites. But he eyes up Denise and starts coming at her with this big axe. So she tries to run. She can't get out the doors. The professor comes up behind her, swings the axe. She dodges. He busts open the door. Now, funny little moment about the trivia here is Rob Zombie says on the commentary how dangerous this scene was, because A, it was a real axe, and B, the professor couldn't see shit. Like, the guy who's playing the professor, he could barely see out of that costume. And they were like, we just assumed Denise would move out of the way. Like, shit. So, again, thank God no one was hurt. But she dodges out of the way. He busts open the door. She goes running. So then up top, we see the Firefly family light up the funeral pyre. And it's just this huge blaze. And then we cut back down to Denise running from the professor. She comes to a dead end. Behind her, we slowly see the professor coming up. And it's that...
That's the one I was talking about. That's that shot where it's her face with him behind her.
Right. And he's coming up. And now this, I'm assuming, is the part that you were talking
about. Oh, my God. He takes his bleh off his mouth and he's like, pucker up. But it looks like a puckered asshole with green goo leaking out of it.
I wrote... He takes his respirator off and horks a big old loogie out of his butt mouth. It's so
and he's like, does that make you horny, baby?
And then he comes running up behind her with the axe. He swings. She dodges again. He misses her and hits a support beam, causing a cave-in on top of them. Then we cut to the next morning, and we see a very banged-up Denise underneath the rubble. She slowly digs her way out and climbs up to the surface. Digs her way out of the ground and out into the sun and staggers toward the road. We see a pink Cadillac driving up the road behind her, and it's driven by none other than Captain Spaulding. And he pulls over and picks her up. She's clearly in shock, talking about how she got away. And he's like, oh my God. He goes, you're the one that everyone's looking for. And she goes, I need a doctor. And he goes, okay, all right, just lean back. I'll get you to a doctor. I'll get you there. And as soon as she leans back and he starts driving again, Otis sits up in the back seat, raises a huge knife, swings it down in slow motion. Denise wakes up. We get a close-up on her face. We hear drilling sounds. We see another shot of Dr. Satan and the professor. She screams. She never actually escaped. It was all just a dream. Then we get the black screen, the end, Ravelli laughs, Kubrick house, and credits.
Yep. And at the very end of the credits, it says, the end, question mark?
Right. I mean, what a fucking ride.
I tried to look up stuff that we don't necessarily talk about. Like, the professor is very interesting to me, and Dr. Satan. How did they get to the appearance that they have right now that we see in the movie? And I could not find anything about either one of them.
Right.
So I'll just make up my own story.
And that's the thing. That's why I like the original ending better. Like, again, don't get me wrong. I love this movie. I love what it is. I love the characters it's given us. I feel like the Dr. Satan and the professor are iconic at this point.
Mm-hmm. What exactly, you said she got chased by zombies. I forget what exactly happened at the ending. It was Grandpa was actually the real Dr. Satan from the legend or whatever. And then,
right. Yes. So the idea was that in the original script, Dr. Satan was Grandpa Hugo, and he is the patriarch of the Firefly family. So they're all, you know, crazy as he is. And they were helping him cover up all of his stuff. So he was making these like weird lobotomized cannibals, and he was keeping them in the mineshaft on their property.
Okay.
So that's basically what they were doing, was he was slowly experimenting on these people, and they were, you know, feeding them other people. So they were cannibals. So like, they weren't technically zombies. They were just like fucked up mutant people. And then of course, when he was hung, the Firefly family are the one that rescued him, because that's their patriarch. So when the kids find them, they found Dr. Satan, and they decide to feed them to their, you know, pet cannibals. And the way that the ending went was Jerry does get eaten by the cannibals, and Mary escapes. There is an avalanche, or there is a cave-in, but it stops the zombies that were chasing her, or the cannibal people that were chasing her. And so there was no professor. Like, he wasn't even there. And after the cave-in, like, the next morning, she wakes up, she crawls out, and she, same thing, she gets out to the road, and Spalding is driving, like, a delivery truck, and he picks her up and, you know, gets her inside, and he's like, are you okay? You know, and she was like, I got away, I need a doctor. And he's like, okay, we'll get you some help. And then Ravelli jumps out of the back of the truck and drags her back there, holding her mouth as he pulls back onto the property of the Firefly family. And we realize he's in cahoots with the Fireflies. So he took her back to them, like she couldn't escape. And that was where it ended. And I thought that was such a good fucking ending. But yeah, you know, it is what it is. I guess that didn't test well.
It makes a lot more sense for even the title now, but yeah, I can see everything kind of fits up better, but I don't know, I do like the axe guy, the professor, and I like the monster stuff at the end, even though I don't think he's ever gonna do any like monster stuff per se. I guess there was a little in Lords of Salem, but
yeah, I mean, but a lot of that was all like also kind of like hallucination type stuff. But I would love to see, since it's now canon, I would love to see more with Dr. Satan and the professor, like, even if it was just like, you know, some kind of like thing he writes, you know, just let us know their origin, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But little bit of trivia that I found, that the house, the Firefly house, is actually the same house used in the Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, which I thought was kind of fun. And then I know we mentioned a lot of it, like the Aleister Crowley thing and all that. And that the film's, the script was constantly changing. So apparently a lot of the actors were having trouble keeping up because he kept changing it. And I think that is one of those things that, again, goes back to what I was saying at the start of a first time storyteller, where you want to get all your ideas in. You know, you want to make sure you do everything you, because this might be your only shot. You want to do it all. And it sometimes makes for a bit of a mess. I think what we got is still a great film.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely shows as a freshman effort, you know. But yeah, I mean, overall, I would highly recommend this to horror fans, especially if, you know, you're fine with a carnival ride of a movie. You know, if you don't study the plot too closely, you'll have fun. You can definitely study the plot much closer in the sequel. But yeah, this, I don't know. So what do you guys think? Any last thoughts on House of Thousand Corpses?
Nope.
If you haven't seen it, watch it. It's on Shudder. It might be on Prime, but it's.
I think it's on all of them right now. Netflix has it and everything.
Because I watched it on Prime.
I watched it on Shudder, which doesn't have Devil's Rejects, but I know Prime has it because it's in my queue.
Right.
I watched it a few days back, and I watched just a couple days before it, The Addams Family, the 1991 or 2 movie.
Oh, that's such a great movie.
I love that movie.
And they strangely make a good pairing.
I can see that.
I could have swapped those kids out for like any of the normal people that visit the Addams Family and get like tortured by weird things in their house. that's my thesis, I guess, for House of Thousand Corpses.
Addams Family is the all ages version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, so just as always, our social media, if you guys aren't following us, we are The Boogeyman's Closet on Facebook and Instagram. Maurice is in charge of our Twitter, which is
at Boogeyman's The.
Thank you, good sir. And I'm sure by now anyone listening already knows about our contests, but definitely check it out. We're doing giveaways right up through the end of the year. this month is insane, being that it is October, and, you know, it's kind of like our Christmas. We have two massive prize packages. And I mean, good God, I was shocked with some of the donations that we got. A lot of them I want to keep, but I'll be good. I'm putting them in the prize packs. There's still a lot of time to get in on the contest. So if you guys haven't entered, check us out on social media. You have a chance to enter. Again, thank you to everyone who has donated. It really is amazing, the outpouring of donations that we've had. And I may just have something up my sleeve for Halloween night. So I'm just going to put that out there. And Eric, thank you for joining us. As always, it's a pleasure.
Thanks for having me again, guys.
Of course. Oh,
anytime.
Anytime.
Couple other things I just wanted to mention real quick is if you guys aren't listening to Getting Scaried Away, definitely worth your time. Really fun podcast, another local podcast, along with the Horrified Chicken. We always mention our friends there. I still go back and re-listen to a lot of their older episodes. They're Sean and Nicole just crack me up. And we also have, I know this is not horror related, but our friends do a great Simpsons podcast called So It's Come to This, a Simpsons Family Podcast. If you guys like The Simpsons, if, you know, you want some wholesome fun, not our normal sweary dem titties, you know, kind of talk, go check them.
No Sister Diddlin or corpse fucking.
Yes.
All right.
So, yeah, I think that'll wrap us up for another episode. Had a lot of fun with this one. But all good things come to an end. So, as always, this is Mike saying goodbye.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard, follow us on Instagram at The Boogeyman's Closet, where you can stay up to date with everything we have planned.